Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. What is Biden aiming to achieve escalating the Ukraine proxy war? How should we interpret Russia's reaction? And finally, where is Donald Trump in all of this? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Goggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Istanbul, we cross to Tariq Sarı-Omar. He is a historian and political commentator. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Okay, let's kick it off with George in Budapest. So much can be said about what's happened in the last 10 days that's even hard to begin to start. I suppose overall, anticipating the Trump administration, are we up in for 60 days of nuclear chicken, George?
It could well be. The Biden administration has obviously determined to escalate the conflict in Ukraine. I mean, I think there's two reasons for that. I mean, obviously, first of all, you know, they're really angry about the victory of Donald Trump and the humiliation that they just suffered at the hands of Donald Trump, and thus want to box him in by the time he gets into power, because he could well have a full-scale war on his hands. 2 months is a long time. You can do an awful lot of mischief in 2 months. But there's a deeper consideration at play here, and that really goes back to what the American strategy has been in this war in Ukraine, and that is to degrade, humiliate, and demoralize and defeat Russia. Because it's obvious that these attacks, whether it's ATACMS, and even with these drone attacks, these are NATO attacks on Russian territory. Ukraine doesn't have the means, the capability to launch long-distance attacks on Russian territory without satellite technology information, without information about flight patterns. All of this is done by NATO. So therefore, if the NATO gets into the situation whereby Russia just sits still and accepts that NATO has the right to attack Russians, kill Russians on Russian territory, then Russia ceases to be a great power. Russia then is relegated to the status of a North Vietnam or an Iraq or a Syria or a Libya that get bombed on a regular basis by the great powers, but they're unable to do anything to retaliate. And I think that's what the goal is, to just to keep doing this to Russia and say, well, look, Russia's unable to do anything about it.
I think that's why
Russia really has to say, no, we cannot allow this situation to go on.
And they have said no, because they fired that hypersonic ballistic missile, which is quite extraordinary, some of the footage I've seen of it here. Tariq, this is what Russia does when the West escalates. They return the favor. And I still think the Western powers, with the exception of the UK for some reason, hasn't really been able to digest and understand that Russia will not tolerate this type of behavior. And Russia has changed its nuclear doctrine to reflect that. I mean, the West wants to escalate. Russia has matched that escalation. Tariq.
No, I think matching is exactly, it's a key term here, right? Because when you look at what Putin has been saying about this publicly on TV in an address to the nation and obviously the world, he has stressed several times that there will always be a response, make no mistake. But he's also used the word symmetrical again and again. And sometimes he's used the word mirroring, right? And so I think that's exactly the Russian strategy right now, is to respond, but in a way that exactly matches the Western escalation, but doesn't up the ante beyond that, as it were. Because I think George is right. One horn of the dilemma, right? That's what he has described. The dilemma that Western strategy tries to impose on Russia is, if you don't do anything, we humiliate you. We relegate you to secondary, tertiary status in the international system, as it really is. But the other horn of the dilemma, of course, is, if you do the wrong thing, we may finally be able to activate the full force, whatever it is, of Article 5 of the NATO treaty, and so everything we have at you. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't actually think NATO would necessarily win. But of course, whoever wins such a large-scale war, right, it would always be a catastrophe for everybody, including for Russia. Nobody would be well off in the end, right? So that's the dilemma, I think. And I feel what Russia is trying to do is always finding exactly the symmetrical, the mirroring, the calibrated response. No response, but some response, and it has to match.
Yeah, but matching it, now we're going to go into the realm of extreme danger, George, because I mentioned the UK a few seconds ago. These missiles that are being fired into Russia, they're British, okay? They're manufactured there, presumably the technicians along with it, using either their own or American satellite technology. There's kind of a lead up to, George, that if NATO is going to attack Russia, then Russia may attack the country that is producing these missiles, killing Russians. This is where we're going, George.
I think so. And I think that in Putin's speech a few nights ago, he did specifically say that given that these missiles are being used by British technicians or NATO technicians, that NATO is providing the satellite technology, effectively, NATO is bombing our territory. Therefore, we feel that we can respond to against those countries on their territories who are providing the weapons for Ukraine to use against us. And that's as explicit as he's ever said anything. We can attack the territory of those powers that provide these missiles and this missile technology to Ukraine. So that's a clear warning. And so I think that now that he has made this warning, then I think Russia will have to follow through, because if this does happen again, and I think it will happen again, then Russia has to follow through. And then, of course, it does raise the question, well, what happens then? Now, of course, Britain will, of course, say this is unprovoked aggression against us, and you know, and then we'll go to NATO and say, well, Article 5, you know, that's it, you know, one for all for one. We are all at war now with Russia. But then what will other the NATO powers say? Because, you know, this was clearly provoked, and now they're being dragged into a war against a nuclear power when they had nothing to do with this attack.
Well, essentially, George, the Hungarians will say, well, it wasn't a Hungarian missile that was fired into Russia.
That's right. And it's particular when you consider that the countries like Hungary and Slovakia and the Czech Republic, they're all much closer to Russia. And so they're going to say, well, hey, we're going to get clobbered because of you. So thanks, but no thanks. You know, I don't think this is the right time to start invoking Article 5.
Of course not. Of course, this will be terrible, right? Absolutely. I'm not arguing for it. But look, George, I agree mostly, but I disagree on one point. I read Putin's statement a tiny bit differently, but I think it's important. As far as I understand, he said the military installations of the powers that are, so to speak, behind Ukraine, we have a right to attack those. And I think there are two important points. One is a military installation can very well be on their territory, and the Russians have certainly not ruled that out. They completely agree with you. But it could also be on, for instance, territory of a NATO member somewhere in the newer NATO states, which is, I think, a very important zone here, right? It's still NATO. Don't get me wrong. That's still very dangerous. The other thing is, I think we have to take the Russians very seriously when they say we have the right, because the Russians are not like, they use this differently from Western politicians. When you hear Western politicians say Ukraine has the right, then they mean Ukraine must. Ukraine has the right to get into NATO. Therefore, Ukraine must get into NATO. The Russians don't think like that, and they're right. They're much more logical. Well, the Russians are saying we can. They're essentially reserving the option, right? But I still agree with you. This doesn't take away the initial problem, which is when they never exercise the right, then they get demoted geopolitically. So the issue is still there. I'm just saying that at the point of decision, right, imagine another Ukrainian strike with attackers right again into key Russian territory. At the point of decision, it seems to me that the Russian leadership, fortunately, has reserved itself some room for maneuver. They're much wiser. They're much more adult in the room than the West in this way, I feel.
Well,
I think that's quite so, because the problem is that by restraining themselves in the way they have for the past 3 years, they have encouraged NATO to take one bold step after another and to keep escalating. So, they didn't react. They were, from the start, they were very cautious. Oh, Russia didn't react. Yeah. So let's, you know, up the ante. Oh, they still haven't reacted. Okay, yes, well, let's now do this. And so step by step, you know, from bringing in the Abrams tanks, you know, the F-16s, the, you know, the cluster munitions, the HIMARS, and then the ATACMS, you know, at each step, you know, they were watching carefully, will Russia respond?
Yeah.
And when they're upping the ante.
You're absolutely right, but I think it's something that you and I talked about earlier, is that over this 3 years and watching Russia's reaction to escalation, now we're at a point is that if a military base that is hit in the UK with warning, with, you know, of hours warning, get your people out, you know, whatever, it's going to be kind of incumbent upon the UK government to say, well, this is an unprovoked attack, but with all of this discussion, no one's going to say, well, what did you expect? They told you that this could happen, because this is, it wouldn't be against NATO, it'd be against the UK. Go ahead, George, before we finish.
I think that's what will happen. I think that it will be a British military installation, and I think the Russians will give advance warning. And of course, the British government and the British media will scream that this was an unprovoked attack. But I don't think there'll be too many buyers to this. We'll say, this has been going on for 3 years. You've had warning after warning after warning, and you haven't paid any attention to it. So
and you've been striking Russian territory.
And that's right. So that's why I think the attempt to invoke Article 5 is, I think, doomed. I think there'll be too many NATO member states that'll say, no, I don't think so. I think we need to just cool things down.
Well, that's what we all will hope, that cooler heads will prevail. But we've been asking that, praying for that for the last 3 years. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lell here. We're discussing some real news. Tedik, let me go to you in Istanbul. The other side of this very complicated equation is Trump proofing NATO and boxing him into a corner. And, you know, if again, looking at some of the people that are in the Trump orbit, we have very different ideas coming from them.
Yes.
Everyone cut off the aid. You cut off the aid, the war comes to an end. There are others who are saying, no, the way Trump is going to end this, he's going to uber escalate and he's going to tell the Russians to knock it all off. Okay. I mean, you have very different extremes here. Who is speaking for Trump? What Trump's mind is, we don't know. Mm-hmm. I think all of us would agree it's rather peculiar that the Trump and his immediate circle have been really quite mum on what's going on right now. Now, is that because of the Logan Act and all these kinds of things? We can discuss it. But I think it's obvious to say that Trump is being given a fait accompli, his new administration. They're going to have to deal with facts on the ground generated two months before inauguration. Go ahead, Tariq.
You know, I think you're absolutely right. The Trump factor and the change of administration is very important. And what the Biden administration is doing now, I mean, it's not just the ATACMS permission, which is more than a permission, right? It's also the landmines, anti-personnel landmines. It's the sanctions against Gazprom Bank, which is another very aggressive move. It's that they've gone out of the way. I mean, Blinken said that. He basically said, we are going to push every dollar we have out of the door before this is over, right? Before we are over. And the only thing that's restraining them a tiny bit is that most of these dollars have to spend within stockpiles of the Pentagon, and the stockpiles are actually low. But they're taking every step, almost, that you can imagine to make things worse, right?
Daddy, can I just interrupt real quick here? Can you explain to our audience, how does this approach help Ukraine?
It doesn't. Absolutely not. Well, that's the point. They're making it worse for everybody, as they've been making it worse for Ukraine now for over 2 years. Everything they've done has just increased Ukrainian sacrifices, Ukrainian destruction, and of course has also imposed terrible costs on Russia and also to an extent on the West itself. This is a cluster something. Absolutely, right? But here's the thing. I don't think it's that easy to box in Trump. All this talk about Trump proving either foreign policy towards Ukraine, aid to Ukraine, or NATO as a whole. It's actually, I'm sorry, but that's whistling in the dark forest. They couldn't Trump-proof the elections. They will not Trump-proof against Trump once the guy is in power. Now, your other point is, of course, correct. We don't know what the collective Trump is up to, right? The people around him. Now, we've heard a little bit. Michael Waltz came out on a Fox interview and was a tiny bit critical of the Biden move. Donald Trump Jr. came out on X and was much more explicit against what the Biden administration did with the attackums. But I still agree with you. We have heard relatively little. So we are out there to guess. But so are the Russians, right? And I think one very important thing is that the Russian leadership, I feel, has good reasons not to be too pessimistic about incoming Trump from their perspective. And that is good news for us still, because it means that the Russian leadership has an incentive not to let itself be lured into this very, very late super escalation by the Bidenistas. I mean, the Russians are looking at this too, and they see the Bidenistas are now gambling for everything they have, but they also know we say 60 days is a long time. I agree. But on the other hand, it's only 60 days, right? You get through this, you have another ball game.
Yes, but George, so much can happen in 60 days if you've already pointed out here. I mean, this is what makes this so dangerous right now, because this really is, I mean, we use the metaphor, a game of chicken, but this is the real thing. It's happening in front of our eyes, George.
Yeah, I think so, because I think 60 days is a very long time. And we used to say a week is a long time in politics, but 60 days is an awful long time in geopolitics. And again, if Russia fails to respond properly to a series of very serious attacks on its territory by NATO powers, then again, Russia ceases to be a great power. Now, in terms of Trump, I don't know whether the Russians really have any great hopes for Trump. They had hopes for Trump back in 2016, 2017, and I think they were very disappointed. They'll look at this administration that Trump has put together, and they're going to be looking for, well, where are the voices for peace? I mean, Trump sold himself at the beginning of the campaign. And we have to remember, this was at the beginning of the campaign when he was seeking the party's nomination, and he had to appeal to his base. He had to appeal to MAGA, who really hated this Ukraine venture. And he made all sorts of statements then about the warmongers, the neocons, the people who keep dragging America into wars. You know, he's going to bring this Ukraine war to an end. We're not going to risk World War III. He said that at the beginning, and then that evaporated once he secured the nomination and then actually helped Speaker Mike Johnson to secure the $100 billion aid package. So if you then look at this Trump team, you then say, well, where is somebody like Colonel Douglas McGregor? He'd be a voice for peace. Where's Rick Grenell? He also would probably be a voice for peace. Where's Rand Paul? He'd also be a voice for peace. These people who are there in the administration, the people who will actually be involved in policymaking, they're all hawks. This is administration.
And Matt Gaetz,
the one person who he appointed, who really is unambiguously a spokesman for MAGA, Matt Gaetz, he survived for 8 days. And significantly, Trump didn't expend any political capital to try to save him. He could have done so. He could have fought for him. He didn't. So if the Russians are looking, and they're going to say, well, you know, this is going to be like a rerun of the first term. You know, yeah, he talks a good game, but when push comes to shove, he really doesn't do very much. And that's why I think that Russians are not thinking in terms of, oh, well, we better hold off because I think we're going to get this some great deal with Trump. I don't think they're going to do that. I think they're going to be what's best immediately.
I think, Tariq, the way things stand right now, and things could change by the end of the day, the way things are changing, is that, you know, we could kind of just split the baby here, is that Trump is going to be a hawk on Russia, push for this ceasefire, which will not happen because the Russians won't agree with it, make Ukraine some kind of fortress state, but that no more funding for an aggressive war. You know, I see that logic in MAGA world around and around and around. It doesn't make any sense because, you know what? Oh, you didn't talk to the Russians about it, okay? Fine. But I think that's the treadmill they're on right now. Yeah. Go ahead.
But look, here's the problem. We have guesses, all of us, about what Trump will really do, right? And we are really talking about two questions, namely our guesses and what are the Russians guessing, right? So if I go back to the question that George also addressed just now, which is what are the Russians guessing, I agree with him on one thing. I don't think they have hope for Trump and they don't expect a great deal just because Trump is coming in. There I agree. But I also believe they have reason to wait with very strong responses because they don't know the opposite either. Like, look at it as this, empirically. If the Russian leadership had already made up its mind that it's absolutely all the same, we have nothing to expect from the Trump change, why did they actually strike back in an extremely restrained manner to the first attack camps and storm shadow users on Russian territory? Why did they do that? Because their response, the first response, was very restrained. It's even possible that the Oreshnik that they fired at Dnipro, right, that it didn't even have explosive warheads, not to speak of nuclear warheads. It's possible from the small craters it left that they just used kinetic warheads, which is the smallest thing you can possibly do in terms of destruction, in which case...
But also, Teddy created a visual that was very, very...
I know. That's the second point. In which case, they took care to have minimum destruction, but with maximum demonstration effect. We don't know this yet, but this is one possibility of what they've done. What we do know is they didn't strike Poland, they didn't strike Zizhou, they didn't strike a base in Germany. They actually still acted in a very restrained way. Right. And then they addressed the West again and warned us again. So we have actually reason to think that the Russian leadership does not believe it's all the same. I agree with George. I think they're realists. They're not dreamers. They don't sit there and think, oh, Trump is going to fix this for us. He's our friend. Of course not. But they have reason to think if we wait for another 60 days, we might be playing in a more advantageous environment. Right. And one thing the Russian leadership has shown us over the extent of this war and even beyond the crisis since 2014, that they're capable of long-term planning, very much unlike our leadership.
George, this demonstration, it showed capacity, but it didn't show intent. And I think that's very interesting. What I think is very... It's going to be very tedious over the next 2 months, which I'll be talking to both of you multiple times during that time, is that it's kind of like being in a relationship that's with someone that's lost their mind, because you have to expect the unexpected. Yeah. And of course, Western audiences have never been told is that this, from Russia's perspective, this is an existential threat. NATO, this is a craven choice. That's the difference of the different sides. Go ahead, George.
I think that's a very important point because if you watch the commentary in the last few days, they all this, oh, Putin is just saber-rattling. Oh, Putin is just blustering. We need to stand up to Putin. We need to make clear to Putin that, we're not going to be intimidated by his saber-rattling. He may have nuclear weapons. We also have nuclear weapons. This is the gist of the commentary. But they don't seem to appreciate that, hey, for Russia, this is an existential matter. They are ready to escalate to whatever, to nuclear weapons if necessary. And when it comes to the West, no president since 1945 has ever said that the borders in Eastern Europe, the regimes in Eastern Europe are a matter of vital national interest in the United States and one that is worth sacrificing American lives for. Again, we saw what Eisenhower in 1956 in Hungary, we saw Lyndon Johnson in 1968 over Czechoslovakia, Ronald Reagan in Poland in 1981. Not one of these presidents said it is worth sacrificing American lives and to bring the planet to the point of destruction over the, what happens there. When he came to Cuba, what happened in the American hemisphere? Yes, at that moment, the American president said, yes, we are ready to go all the way up to nuclear war. But here, his comment, you said they're off their rocker. Yeah, this kind of commentary is off their rocker.
You know, to finish up, gentlemen, what I think is really dangerous is that the cabal in the Biden administration, they see this as the last chance to contain and even break up Russia, and their dreams are in tatters right now. I think that explains this wild escalatory process in front of our eyes. It's going into hope, and hope dies first and last in this case. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and in Istanbul. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.